Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, can new media restructure power relations? And if so, how? Then, what does the conviction of Liberian President Charles Taylor truly reveal about the international justice system? Can the internet and social networks change power relations? Our next guest says they already are doing that. With trust as the central issue, he says that people with new communication tools are challenging big business, big government, and big media. Rory O'Connor is a writer, filmmaker, and co-founder of the international media firm Global Vision. He's the author of numerous books, including Shock Jocks, Hate Speech and Talk Radio, and his latest, Friends, Followers in the Future, How Social Media Are Changing Politics, Threatening Big Brands, and Killing Traditional Media. Welcome, Rory O'Connor.
Thank you so much. It's a great pleasure.
Some of the statements that you say right up top about how new media are allowing people to bypass state censorship, outpace traditional news organizations, compel corporations to listen and act on their demands, and compel governments to listen. Can you give us examples of each of these?
Well, you know, first of all, the how, you know, as I posit in the book, it's because these new media tools and technologies are deeply disruptive. And, of course, they enable almost anyone to, for the first time in history, produce and distribute news and information very widely and inexpensively and inefficiently, and to create almost instant networks of like-minded people and amplify their voices. So, you know, that's the how of it. And I think, you know, there are examples everywhere. The subtitle of the book, as you know, is How Social Media Are Changing Politics, Threatening Big Brands, and Killing Traditional Media. So, you know, let's look at the big brands, for example. It wasn't so long ago that the Bank of America, which I think certainly qualifies as a big brand, decided that they were going to raise the debit card charges to people who banked with them. And there was an instant uproar in the social media, and the Bank of America executives were forced to back down in a record period of time. So, you know, that's an example, and there are many, many others. If you look in politics, you know, I'm sitting here in Oakland. I was just down in Ogallala Plaza the other day when the Occupy movement on May Day came back with a vengeance, if you will. And I think there are many, many examples, both domestically and obviously on the international front, with the fall of the Mubarak regime in Egypt being the highlight, I suppose. And when it comes to the traditional media, you know, boy, that's almost an old story at this point. Just about everybody knows what's been happening to them, the legacy media brands that have, you know, really lost vast swaths of their audience and lost the trust of their audience, most importantly. You know, one of the things I look at in the book is how the Gallup organization has been polling Americans about their trust of the media over time. And you know, back in the 1970s, more than 75% of the American people indicated they had a high level of trust in the traditional media. Those figures are now below 25%. So I think in those areas and many, many more. You know, education, of course, is one of the other areas that's about to be disrupted in a big way. So my message beyond the big media, big politics, and big business is that if you are in a sector of our economy or our culture that has yet to be disrupted by these emerging media, just wait.
Well, a couple of things I'd like to back up of what you said. One is you talked about how people are losing trust in the mainstream media. Don't you also think that the concerted effort by certain political provocateurs, for lack of a better word, their concerted campaign against what they called the liberal media through the 90s and early 2000s, do you think that that actually whittled down the trust in media ahead of time?
No, I don't. I don't think that this is a political response, because I find that people on the right and on the left, one of the few things they seem to share these days in our highly polarized political situation here in the United States, is a distrust of the mainstream media. I would say that it's mainly because of poor performance over time. In other words, it's because the legacy media have demonstrated repeatedly that they simply are not worthy of their trust of the audience any longer.
And then at the same time, it sounds like they've built trust in other media institutions. For example, you mentioned Comedy Central.
Well, yes, exactly. Back in the day, in the 20th century, when we had an old, centralized, and a lot more hierarchical media system, you know, there were only three networks, for example, and they basically told you the same news at the same time every day. And there was a fellow named Walter Cronkite, who was then rated as by far the most trusted journalist in the country. And he would end his newscast by saying, well, that's the way it is. And what we find now is that we're in a world where the old centralized, hierarchical, non-participatory forms, you know, no longer apply. And you mentioned Jon Stewart. Over that 40 years that Gallup has been trusting things, the most trusted journalist in America has gone from being the anchorman of CBS News to being, and I don't mean this in a derogative or pejorative way, but to being a self-avowed clown in the person of Jon Stewart.
And at the same time, the traditional media are increasing some of their audiences by using these same internet, social networking, YouTube. There's a merging going on. While they're maybe losing listeners and viewers on one hand, they're gaining them on the other. How do we make sense of this?
The way to make sense of it is to realize, well, first of all, that we literally are in the midst of a revolution. We're actually right at the beginning of a revolution, to put it better. And it's a revolution that's on a par with the Gutenberg Revolution. Obviously, that's a truism, but it's true nonetheless. So, you know, revolutions are very chaotic affairs. They're messy. No one, you know, they go up, they go down. There are winners, there are losers, there is conflict. And that's the situation we're in now. Now, generally speaking, now specifically to your point, my position vis-a-vis traditional journalists, traditional media and social media is that those entities that rather than sticking their heads in the sand, ostrich-like, and just hoping that it all goes away, that actually try to engage, that embrace them, if you will thrive. And those that do not simply will not survive. And I look at two entities in the book in some detail, ABC News and NBC News, and talked extensively to the people who headed the digital news operations there. You know, the fellow at ABC News basically almost left the room when I asked him why we should trust ABC News. He was almost incensed, and his answer was, well, because we're ABC News. Whereas the fellow at NBC News said that his strategy was that NBC News wants to be your friend. And what he meant by that is exactly what you're saying, that they would extend their news into all sorts of platforms, social as well as traditional. And also he made the point that one of the things that they did that was not at all in their experience was to link out to many other forms of media and news and information, including to their competitors at ABC, for example. And I can tell you, in the old days, that is something you would never dream of doing. But in this new media economy, that actually helps to build trust with your audience, because you're saying, you know, as a friend, if you will, as a trusted referral of news and information, I at NBC News want to be your go-to place where you can literally get all the information that you need, even if it comes from somebody that is supposedly a competitor to me.
So a few aspects. One is the issue of trust. And you wrote about how brands were traditionally how people developed trust. It was kind of this familiarity, and how that is changing now. At the same time, we are losing our traditional gatekeepers, or have lost, I should say. And that's a bit of a double-edged sword from what I see. For example, the gentleman that just died, Andrew Breitbart, who used to doctor videos, put them up on the web, perform these sting operations, destroyed people's livelihoods from these videos that were really not true, and yet people saw them and believed them.
Well, some people did, but you know, a lot of people realized after the first couple of instances that when news came of, you know, the latest, and you're referring in part to James O'Keefe, you know, the conservative so-called investigative reporter who would do these stings and scams against outfits like Acorn. Now, after it was revealed that there were great flaws, if you will, to put it mildly, in the so-called journalism that he was practicing, well, you know, the second or third time after that had happened, a lot of people just went, oh, you know, that's the same old thing, and it turned out not to be true in the past. So, you know, you're absolutely right about the trust being the essence of any relationship. You can't have a friendly relationship with someone that you don't implicitly trust. Also, if you think about a brand essentially is a trust relationship. In other words, what does a brand mean? It means that, for example, in the days of the big brands, Coca-Cola, probably the biggest brand in the world. And what did that mean? I mean, you could trust that wherever you went in the world, almost 200 countries, when you would buy a Coca-Cola, you would get the same thing. You would know what it would be. There aren't 180 different versions of Coca-Cola. So that is the essence of what we meant by a brand. Now, what I posit in the book is that the meaning of brand is now being stretched in an era where we're all told we need to create our own personal brands, and in an era where curators are coming in and replacing some of the old legacy brands and becoming micro brands. And at a certain point, if everyone has a brand, then the word brand, at least in the old meaning of it, no longer really applies. But I would say that trust is the central issue that unites all the observations in my book, whether it's about the media itself, and as I said, we've learned not to trust the legacy media, whether it's about big politics, now that the politicians are making their own media and sending it to us and bypassing the legacy media, well, how much of that can we trust? And then certainly we've seen over time that many of the brands, not only legacy media brands, but corporate media brands and the new media brands, including Facebook's and Google's of the world, we've got to question, you know, how much we can trust them as well. You know, Facebook and Google have repeatedly compromised the privacy of their users. You know, Google most recently with Street View was capturing people's private information without telling them. They first denied that they were doing it. They later said it was a mistake. So this is not trustworthy behavior. And, you know, one of the points I make in the book is that if Facebook and Google continue to violate the trust of their users over time, as shocking as it may sound today, those brands could well be highly damaged and go away as well.
Let's talk about other effects. One is social classes. Do you have a sense that, because access is growing, do you have a sense that classes are being impacted? Is it a bridge or is it a divider?
I think what's happening is that things are flattening and democratizing, and so that's at least potentially a very good thing. And you know, we're seeing a lot of growth in internet usage, for example, in minority communities, in the black community, in the Hispanic community. And particularly with the advent of the smartphone, you're seeing actually much higher adoption rates within these communities that, were just a few years ago, we were worrying about a digital divide and how they may not have sufficient access to the internet because, you know, talking about class, you know, not everybody can afford to have a computer of their own or sitting at their home. But we now find that not only with social coming to dominate, but with mobile coming to dominate, there's been a big switch in that. So I do think that there is a flattening, if you will, a democratization, where more and more people who had been excluded in the past now at least have the opportunity to not only to redistribute other news and information, but to create their own and distribute that.
And what about the balkanization effect? Again, is it uniting or is it dividing in terms of where we go and what we watch and what we listen to and read?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. A whole chapter on this in the book, which is called The Daily Me versus The Daily We. I must say, first of all, this is a subject of great controversy and debate. My own take on it is that we are actually not in as great a danger of this balkanization, this polarization, this reinforcement, if you will, of what we already think, which in you know, academic terms is called homophily. In other words, you know, love of the same. Are we getting just more of the same and have our own prejudices backed up rather than learning new things? There is a danger of that, absolutely. There's a couple of dangers of it. One is with real-world social networks offline, which are relatively small and largely comprised of your family and your friends. Well, yes, there is a tendency within those too, because those people are much more like us than others, that, you know, we would hear the same sort of news and information. But one of the main points in my book is that the online social networks differ greatly from these real-world social networks. They have unique characteristics that, in fact, work in the opposite way. You know, if I have 1,000 or more friends, quote-unquote, on Facebook, obviously, these are people that I have looser ties with than my family. But I think it's equally obvious that I'm probably going to be exposed to more diverse news and information as a result, not only of the greater number, but of the variety of people. So I think that that is what's happening with the online social networks in that area, and that's one of the reasons why we don't need to fear that. Now, there is another problem that I must mention, which is that of so-called personalization. And this is something that Eli Pariser, for example, has highlighted, and he wrote a book called The Filter Bubble, where he expressed concern about, let's say, Facebook or Google personalizing the news and information that you get. So, for example, you know, if you were to go on Google and I go on Google and we enter the same search terms, we would probably get different results. Because these both Google and Facebook are now reacting to what they know and learn about us from our online behavior, and then trying to, you know, express that in a personalized way. But there, you know, you can shut those off. For example,
can you actually shut those off?
And you just go into the settings in Facebook or in Google. It's really not that difficult, but. Really, I do feel that both of those entities should do a lot more to make these things easier for people. Because even though it's not that difficult, you know, I just saw a piece today that about 30% of all the people on Facebook actually never go into the settings and exert any control over who's seeing what's on their site, over their privacy, over what news and information they're getting. I think that if you could create an entity such as Google and Facebook, you ought to be able to come up with a way to make it very transparent to people how they can control what news and information they're getting.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle and The Insiders, Insight into Today's Most Pressing Issues. And I'm Maria Armudian, and we are speaking with Rory O'Connor about his new book, Friends, Followers, and the Future. In terms of social classes and polarization, balkanization, do you have a sense at all about ethnicity and religion and whether this Facebook friending and Googleization is acting as a bridge or a divider?
Well, you know, of course, there are many, many other social networks. And, you know, some of them, I mean, Black Planet, for example, you know, essentially a Facebook for African Americans, you know, Eons, a Facebook for baby boomers. There are many, many different social networks, and there are more every day, many of them in these narrow niches. There's even one called Pair, which is to have a social network between you and one other person, if you could believe that. So there's almost, at this point, an infinite variety. A lot of people I know are involved in more than one social network. You probably won't have a presence on Facebook just because of the so-called network effect, and that means that there's already 900 million people there. But you may well want to have a more specific one in a more narrow area that works for you, either, as you say, in terms of your class or your ethnicity or whatever. And I think that, you know, this is wonderful that there's a great variety out there that people can choose to participate in.
And why do you think an outfit like Facebook has outlasted the others, the MySpace, the Friendster, and why it's trumping in some ways Google?
I could tell you about MySpace because MySpace, for two reasons. One, MySpace always conceived of itself as a media company and really not as a social network. And then the second thing is, of course, they were purchased by the legacy media in the person of Rupert Murdoch and a news corporation for more than, you know, $500 million, and they really didn't know how to run it. And, you know, I think the worth of MySpace at this point is probably about $30 million. So, you know, they lost almost $500 million on MySpace largely because they didn't know what they were doing. So I guess the answer is that, you know, Mark Zuckerberg had a better idea of what he was trying to create, which was not a media company, but really was a social network. Now, in terms of Google, that's a whole other, and I would say probably a lot more interesting question. And it really has to do with this vast paradigm shift that's happening now in the way that we access news and information. You know, Google was obviously revolutionary in the first part of the first decade of the 21st century, revolutionizing through its remarkable search engine how people access news and information. But we're now moving very rapidly into a world where social is replacing search as a focus of online activity. Again, I have a whole chapter on Google in my book, and one of the things I say is that, you know, if you are a search engine company in the social world, you know, that's probably a bad place to be. And Google knows this, which is why they have repeatedly over time, almost since their inception, you know, made forays into social. They bought Friendster, for example. They had a social early, and still have, but it was an early social network named Orkut, which was at one time the leading network in Brazil and India, but it's now been surpassed by Facebook. They later started the disastrous Google Buzz, and of course now they're back with Google Plus. So they understand the need to transition into social. They just may not have the corporate DNA to be able to do it.
So in terms of what we're facing now, and you've gave some really great numbers in the book, and they're probably even outdated as we speak, but something
they
like...
They are. I mean, just, not to interrupt, but my YouTube chapter is called 48 Hours a Minute, which is a reference to the amount of video that was loaded onto YouTube. We're already up to 60 hours a minute.
And this is exactly what I wanted to lead into. Given the morass of data being uploaded, not just YouTube, but on all of these multiple sites, this vast internet, how are people going to sort through, A, fact from fiction, we talked about that a little bit, but also to find the material that might either be, A, excellent or needed? How do people sort through this?
You know, that is the essential question before us now, is how can we find what I call trustworthy or reliable or even credible information when there's literally a tsunami of news and information washing over us, inundating us, and that we're drowning in. So how can we keep from drowning, and how can we separate the signal from the noise? That's the number one issue. Look, we all need shortcuts. Even professional journalists, you know, such as you and I, need shortcuts and filters because the volume is so great. And I posit that there are at least four that people should, you know, investigate and put together as a mix, as a way of at least beginning to deal with the problem. So just very quickly, first of all, the social media themselves, these emerging new networks such as Facebook and Twitter and YouTube itself and so on, I think that's the number one driver, where we can get trusted referrals of news and information from friends and followers, people that we have a relationship with over time. And Facebook is now the leading driver of traffic through the links that are circulated by friends and Facebook to even the legacy news media sites. It's now surpassed Google in search. So that's number one filter, I would suggest, the social media and your friends and followers, you know, hence the title of my book. Now, secondly, there's the rise of the curator, the individual or group of individuals who focus in a sort of a narrow, let's say, vertical information area, let's say the environment. One of the fellows I interviewed in the book was Rob Stewart, and unfortunately he passed away just a few months ago. But prior to that, Rob, in my circles, was the go-to guy for good information about the environment, because he was the pack rat. He got it all. He sorted through it. He told us what was important, what was trustworthy, and what was not. And over time, as we get information from these curators who are aggregating all this other information and kind of sorting it for us, you know, the best will rise, more people will come to them, and they, in fact, will become micro-brands unto themselves. The third one I want to point to, and I must say this is one I had a bias against, is the algorithm, the recommender systems, you know, these learning machines that we can interact with, and over time they learn about not only what we like, but what we need and what we want. And I said I was biased against them. One, I didn't know that much about them. And two, look, if you go on Amazon or something, how do they work now? You buy something and they come on and they offer you like four more things like it. But when I went out and talked to the top tech people and the top academic researchers in the field, to a person they told me, well, this will change. The machines are only in their infancy. And they will get much more sophisticated over time as we interact with them, and that they will play a much bigger role in the future in helping to, you know, provide us with valuable information. And then finally, you know, even though they are dinosaurs, you know, the legacy media still exists, and they're still very large and very powerful and still rampaging over the earth. You know, again, people need to choose. Some people think the New York Times is highly reliable. Other people disagree, and they think Fox News is. So what I say is put together a mix of these four elements that works for you and, you know, adjust it over time. If the legacy media piece of it stops working well, look for other outlets that are more trustworthy. If your curator is sending you bad information, there are other places you can go. But we need to have these filters and shortcuts to help us.
Rory O'Connor, that's a great place to stop. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. I just want to mention, if people, you know, want to follow this over time, I write about it often on my blog, roryoconnor.org.
The name of the book is Friends, Followers, and the Future, How Social Media and Changing Politics, Threatening Big Brands and Killing Traditional Media. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
When we come back, what does the conviction of former Liberian President Charles Taylor really reveal about the international justice system? Next on the Scholar Circle, stay tuned.
How much longer will it be?
You are listening to The Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. Human rights organizations say former Liberian President Charles Taylor is responsible for the deaths of tens of thousands of people, as well as for terrorist acts against civilian populations and enslavement. While many uphold last week's conviction of Taylor as evidence that no one is above the law, critics of the system suggest that it also reveals a flawed international criminal law system, arguing that the system needs an overhaul. Does the international criminal justice system work? If so, how well, and are there better ways to ensure justice? We're joined by three experts. Hannah Gary is director of USC Law's International Human Rights Clinic and specializes in international human rights law, international criminal law, international humanitarian law, and international refugee law. David Kay is Executive Director of UCLA Law School's International Human Rights Law Program and Director of its International Justice Clinic. Mark Drumble also joins us. He is Professor at Washington and Lee University School of Law and Director of the University's Transnational Law Institute there. He is author of numerous books, including the award-winning Atrocity, Punishment, and International Law, and his latest, Reimagining Child Soldiering in International Law and Policy. I would like to start with this conviction of Charles Taylor, how and why it came about, why now, and what this conviction really means for international justice. Professor David Kay, why don't you start?
I think to boil down the Charles Taylor trial into just a few seconds is a pretty difficult thing to do, but let me just identify, if I can, a couple of interesting points from it. And the first thing to note is that the tribunal that at least its trial chamber, convicted Charles Taylor, who was the president of Liberia. The tribunal was established by an agreement between the United Nations and the government of Sierra Leone. So it's a special tribunal. It's actually called the Special Court for Sierra Leone. It was specifically established in order to deal with the crimes that were committed during the civil war in Sierra Leone in the late 90s and early part of this century. And it's special in the sense that we really only have a couple of these hybrid tribunals out there. You know, as your listeners may be familiar, there's the International Criminal Court, which is truly an international court under international law that was established by a treaty. And we have the ad hoc tribunals for the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda that were established by the United Nations Security Council. But this kind of special approach of a hybrid tribunal that actually brings together Sierra Leonean law and international law, brings together personnel from both Sierra Leone and from the international community, both in terms of judges, prosecutors, defense counsel, clerks, and registry officers, is really something interesting and is an important way to think about international justice really getting incorporated into a national system, particularly in a post-conflict setting like Sierra Leone, where its judiciary would probably not be capable of handling this kind of thing on its own. So just in terms of the structure, I think it's very interesting to look at. I think the other thing to think about in terms of this particular conviction isn't only that Charles Taylor was a head of state who's now been convicted, and he's not exactly the first, but he's really the first of the modern heads of state to go through trial and conviction. And his trial took nearly 4 years, so there may be something we want to discuss there about the length of these kinds of trials. But I think, you know, more than it being just Charles Taylor as the president, I think the idea that the international community could come together in this way and work with the national system in order to try somebody, and, you know, really a complicated set of facts, complicated really to address Taylor's responsibility. He was president of Liberia, and we're talking about facts and events that occurred in Sierra Leone. You know, the fact that this trial could actually occur in itself, I think, is pretty notable and important if we're going to talk, as I think you want to, Maria, about enforcement of international human rights and international humanitarian law norms.
Hannah Gary.
Just taking off of David's points there, I would only add that with respect to, as he rightly pointed out, this is a trial that has been concluded by a hybrid tribunal. It's interesting, I think, with respect to this particular trial, that it didn't happen in the region, that it was actually pulled out and that the trial took place in The Hague. So this kind of calls into question some of the goals of some of these hybrid tribunals, for example, bringing justice closer to the victims. And the reason for having the trial in The Hague was in part due to some of the controversy around the trial and security concerns with trying this former head of state. David is quite right that it's a notable conviction in that it is the first conviction we have of a former head of state, modern day anyway. And it's notable, I think, also in the respect that, yes, in fact, it did take a number of years to conclude. And also just the arrest and apprehension of Taylor in and of itself took a lot of diplomatic maneuvering and pressure, and it was quite difficult. But I think that this trial and the conviction does send the message out there to other heads of state who may be engaging in the kinds of behavior that Taylor has been convicted for, which is aiding and abetting the crimes of various groups in Sierra Leone during the Civil War, that sends a message to other heads of state to be aware that that kind of behavior can get a conviction for that at a hybrid or international tribunal, and that also, no matter how far out you may stand trial, because there is no sort of statute of limitations with respect to these types of crimes.
Mark Drumble?
Good to be on and to think about this. And I think one way I'd like to think about it is pivoting off of what Hannah and David had said. I think we need to ask ourselves a question, which is really, in a post-conflict situation, what does justice mean? And it's easy to say that a conviction equates justice, and clearly that's the case here. He's convicted on 11 counts of crimes against humanity and war crimes. I mean, Hannah pointed out it was on an aiding and abetting theory, and that really means he played an important role in facilitating these crimes in Sierra Leone, but the prosecution wanted to convict him either as an individual, in terms of individual criminal responsibility, let's say for ordering, or as part of a broader criminal enterprise, and they were unsuccessful in that regard, but aiding and abetting was a basis for that particular set of convictions. But at the end of the day, you know, it's important for us to take a step back and say, how are the justice interests of people on the ground in Sierra Leone necessarily advanced by this? And it's important for us not to put too much faith into a criminal conviction. And let's add also, Taylor is, he can appeal and he'll only be sentenced in any event at the end of the month. So this is a conviction, but this is not one with certitude yet. The matter is still ongoing. But, you know, for former child soldiers in Sierra Leone, for devastated communities, for elements of society that are trying to rebuild, a criminal conviction in a distant court can be very symbolic. It can also be very expensive, but it can also, at the same time, distract from what really needs to happen on the ground in terms of reintegration, rehabilitation, community reconstruction, and so forth. So I think as people concerned about justice, we need to be circumspect about how much criminal law can advance us towards justice. And if we stop now thinking about what justice means for Sierra Leone and West Africa in general, we're selling ourselves short and we're stopping prematurely. Let me also add, Taylor has committed a lot of crimes in Liberia. And those are not part of this. The mere temporal and jurisdictional focus is on Sierra Leone. And I think that many people can look at the Taylor conviction and view it as partial justice, even in a criminal sense, because there's a lot of people who believe he was involved in much more criminality than merely his support of a particularly brutal rebel group, the RUF, in Sierra Leone.
Well, I think I see three different paths that we should go down. One is how the trial actually takes place. And David Kaye, this is one of your areas, talking about whether it should be done in the state, in the region, in an international setting, whether it should be a hybrid. So that's one important question. A second question deals with two points that Mark Drumble, you just brought up. One is, what is justice? And how is this meaningful to victims in particular? The third item, which David Kaye, you and I have spoken about before too, deals with the issue of selective justice. Maybe we should start with selective justice first, because even within Africa, as I understand it, certain crimes against humanity, human rights violations get prosecuted and others don't. How do these get determined? David Kaye, would you like to start?
I would say that actually your three different paths really converge in a lot of ways. I mean, those issues, you know, the question of selectivity, the question of how we define justice, and the question of where we imagine these kinds of trials happening, I mean, they all really come together in a lot of ways, and it's hard to talk about them separately. Since you're asking about this selectivity issue, I think there's no way around the fact that in any kind of trial, whether we're talking about international or domestic, particularly when we're talking about a post-conflict setting, that there's going to be some more or less political decision as to who gets prosecuted. You know, in the context of international trials, they simply are too expensive to and have too few resources, although they look like they have enormous resources compared to some post-conflict settings, but they have too few resources to try more than the most senior individuals who are responsible for the worst kinds of crimes. That's just a capacity question. But even when you get to the domestic level, courts and other forms of justice really have a difficult time reaching too far down the chain of responsibility. And so there's always going to be the issue of selectivity, I think, even in the most sophisticated kind of system. But that's if we're going to be looking at selectivity with respect to individuals and who will be investigated and prosecuted. There's this other issue of selectivity that I think you're also alluding to, which is which states, which conflicts are subject to prosecution. And I think that is also another area where we're simply, particularly if we're talking about international justice or justice at the international level by international tribunals such as the ICC, that we're also going to face the same situation. In a world of limited capacity, we're going to rely on prosecutors to exercise some discretion, sometimes the Security Council, which might refer a case to the ICC, but there will always be some measure of choice and discretion there that's going to leave out some situations over others. For my part, I'm not sure we have a good metric by which we judge which are the appropriate conflicts to go to international court and tribunal and which aren't. At this point, it seems, you know, fairly political in a lot of ways, particularly if you're looking at why, you know, maybe Libya or Sudan were referred and other cases have not been referred to the ICC for investigation. So just on the selectivity point, and I'll stop here so we can talk about this further and get other reactions, but I think that it's sort of an unavoidable consequence of the criminal justice system that we have today.
Mark Drumble, I know this is an area you've actually written about quite a bit. It sounded like you've been very critical of the system in terms of it being almost too Western. What's your response?
Well, I think that is an important point. If we think of selectivity as only who is prosecuted and what is prosecuted, we're failing to realize that there's the already tremendous level of selectivity in what we understand justice to mean, namely Western-style criminal trials. And I think if we truly think of a pluralistic understanding of justice, we need to do a lot more in terms of bringing in alternate forms of dispute resolution, truth commissions, reparations, in the context of Sierra Leone, completely irrelevant to, in many ways, the notion of individual guilt, is the structural factors that help support violence in Sierra Leone. The blood diamond trade, for example, intercessions of Western powers or failures to intercede. And these are all factors that conspire together and allow atrocity to become truly massive. And I really do think, to some degree, we get hung up when we say, oh, the rebel LRA are getting prosecuted in Uganda, but the Ugandan government is not, even though it committed some human rights abuses. And, oh, it's only the genocidal Hutu regime that was prosecuted in Rwanda, whereas the Paul Kagame regime today, the RPF regime, is not subject to any prosecution, even though they committed some human rights abuses as well and continue to do so. I think what that fails to really uncork is the major problem, which is international experts create criminal tribunals to deal justice. And that, to me, is a very narrow understanding of justice, and in many ways it fails to bring into play what a lot of local communities envision as a justice process, and distant incarceration and formalistic rules of procedure where a lot of evidence is out for reasons that have more to do with technical perfection and legalism than necessarily accuracy or a story that needs to be told, at the end of the day, leads in many ways to selective truths. We would be well served, and we would worry less about selectivity within the criminal law if we had much more than just criminal law standardized and mainstreamed as methods of justice. Every time there's a major conviction that comes down, conversations happen, the media reports, people pat themselves on the back when there's a conviction and say, we're an inch closer in the arc of justice. But at the end of the day, when the conviction is done, people still continue to live in post-conflict zones, and we cannot ever overestimate how their needs for justice are going to be satisfied just by this criminal conviction.
What you speak of is really almost a revamping of the entire legal thinking and culture. Hannah Gary, you've actually been in the trenches. What do you think of this?
In some respects, I do agree with Mark. There is a danger with the focus over the last 15, 20 years on international criminal law and tribunals, hybrid, or international criminal law trials at the national level as being the answer, the main way to get justice. There's a real danger in that there are other understandings of justice, and we really need to have a more nuanced, contextual approach with respect to that understanding, and also the realization that in different parts of the world, justice means different things for different communities. Also, there's the danger that we say we got that conviction and our job is done as the international community in working with a post-conflict society and not moving forward to address the root causes and the deeper problems that led to the conflict and the crimes in the first place. That being said, I do want to push back a bit in the sense that I do think that there is a universal sense among victims around the world that these trials are important, that it is important for us to, as the international community, to say enough with impunity. And even though that justice is selective, not everyone is tried that should be tried. Moving forward, taking steps towards trying some of the most senior leaders is important, and it's imperfect, but we continue to try, and with a permanent international criminal court, with the complementarity regime, hopefully we're closing the gaps with respect to some of that selectivity, and there are more convictions being reached, hopefully in the future, and at the same time, other forms of justice being addressed, such as restorative justice with getting victims more involved, awarding of reparations, et cetera. So I agree, but I do want to sort of hold to the idea that it's still critically important and that international criminal trials are not necessarily just a Western position on the world.
David Kaye.
I also want to jump in here just because I think it's a very interesting discussion, particularly to respond to Mark, with whom I agree on this. I think it's important to note that in post-conflict settings, I mean, this isn't the case everywhere, of course. Last week, I was with a group of Syrian human rights activists who were trying to think through what justice after Assad might look like. And they do talk about all the different levers of justice in all the different meanings that might be out there. And as you look over the last 15 to 20 years at experience in post-conflict and post-authoritarian regime societies, it's really true that you don't just have criminal justice. You do have truth commissions. You do have reparations regimes. You have vetting processes to ensure that your bureaucracies don't have holdovers with personnel who've committed crimes. There are really many, many tools out there. And I think one of the important things that I take in part from what Mark was saying was none of these should be exclusive of others, that in thinking about justice, there are a lot of purposes out there. Some of the purposes are social for the society that was the subject of the atrocities. Some of the purposes might also be for the international community and establishing norms of appropriate behavior at the most senior levels of governance. So I think that it is important to think about all of these different mechanisms as each having some value, and I, you know, wholeheartedly agree with the idea that the focus only on criminal justice, to the extent that exists, is really problematic and doesn't get at all the different kinds of needs that exist after a conflict.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the international criminal justice system. David Kaye, one of the things you've talked about in the past with us is when you move the justice system a little bit closer to home, it actually may help develop a culture of justice and a culture of rule of law. Is that something that the West is perhaps pushing on to other places? Not to say that we don't need a rule of law, although sometimes the law is written for the powerful. How do we reconcile all of this with regards to rule of law, moving things into a culture that is more justice-oriented. Also, what to do in the cases where the laws are truly unjust.
Well, I don't think we can expect too much. I mean, there's a risk of having too high of an expectation for international criminal trials, even when they're in hybrid tribunals that take place on the ground, as we see in Freetown in Sierra Leone or in Phnom Penh in Cambodia, where the Khmer Rouge Tribunal is taking place. I think if we ask too much, if we ask these tribunals to really serve as some kind of demonstration effect for justice in those countries, I think we may be asking a little too much. I think it's important to ensure that those processes don't simply seem so opaque and so beyond the experience of one of the intended audiences, that is the national community, that they look not only as if they're genuinely foreign, but the truth that might come out, the stories that might come out of these courts and tribunals are not really understood by the people, by their audiences. So I think that's really important. At the same time, I do think that to the extent that the international community, that aid organizations can start to see that there is some value in using either the hybrid or international tribunals or simply in supporting domestic initiatives to try their own individuals at home, that should be a focus for aid agencies in the future. And again, I don't think it needs to focus solely on the criminal courts. It could be all these different mechanisms of justice that Hannah and Mark have identified. But there's definitely a need for there to be the development of rule of law in these post-conflict settings. I think people want rule of law, the people in these countries, and there needs to be support for that. We spend a lot of time and money focusing on the international tribunals when focusing on how we can help national communities take ownership of their own justice systems is probably the more important thing over the long term.
Mark Drumble, one of your pieces talked about how these things are so complex and yet we try to apply kind of simplistic mechanisms. Can you elaborate on that as well?
Well, sure. The superimposition of criminal law on situations of atrocity with its simple categories of guilty and innocent, I think really glosses over the reality that in order for atrocity to become massive, massive numbers of people are involved with a very sublime level of degrees of responsibility, many of whom are not attaining a level of responsibility that the criminal law can grasp. I mean, the criminal law was barely able to grasp Taylor's responsibility. That's why it had to rely on his aiding and abetting theory. And even on that, the alternate judge issued some kind of a dissent at a press conference afterwards, saying there wasn't even enough of a basis to establish beyond a reasonable doubt Taylor's involvement in aiding and abetting this particular conduct. So imagine trying to grasp the levels of responsibility of bystanders, of people who look away when people are getting killed, of people who advance in the social structure because they're part of the right group as opposed to the wrong group. But all of those forms of human agency mesh together to create atrocity, and the criminal law doesn't have the vocabulary to deal with that, but that's a condition precedent to atrocity, so that's why we need much more in terms of what justice means. I also think it's important for us to emphasize these tribunals are very expensive. The Rwanda tribunal, the average cost per conviction is at least $25 million. And this is a country with a per capita GDP that's maybe a couple of thousand dollars U.S. I also think if we're going to start thinking about what victims want, I think it's crucially important for us, and in a lot of my own work with victims, I've heard victims express wants that international law doesn't want to hear. And those are wants that range the gamut from vengeance to forgetting. I've worked with a lot of victims in East Africa who simply view a justice process, whatever the justice process is, as investing more time, once again, in the pain of the past as opposed to moving on. And we have to be very careful in this sense with all forms of justice mechanisms. Take a restorative or reconciliatory forms of justice. One refrain that I've heard often in the Rwandese context, where to some degree there are national measures that had been put in place to try to promote community reconciliation is I've worked with victims, and the victims have said, I don't want to forgive the person who did this particular crime to me. And if a requirement of participating in a restorative process is that I forgive openly a perpetrator for the violence that he committed in exchange for him having admitted to the violence and asking for forgiveness, the victims have often reported to me that they feel they're giving away the only vestige of moral condemnation and power that they have to themselves, and that is the power to not forgive or not communicate that forgiveness. So I think we need to be careful when we think about what victims want and understand that international law, if it's truly going to be pluralistic, is going to have to deal with certain uncomfortable realities.
Hannah Gary, you get the last word.
Coming off of what Mark just said, his discussion about how, with respect to these types of crimes, take whole societies, in fact. A great example is Cambodia, the numbers of individuals that were involved. And it's true, it's very difficult to conceive and think of justice with respect to a society like that where so many were involved, and it's a totalitarian state at the time. So there's questions about duress and inability to choose. I also completely agree with Mark with respect to, you know, really thinking carefully about what victims want. At the same time, I again come back to that perhaps, though, with respect to some of the most senior level, the highest level, you know, heads of state like Charles Taylor, that perhaps we should make a claim as the international community that, in the end, international criminal trials are required for the very highest level leaders who facilitate and make possible such mass criminality, who have the choice to do that, not only for purposes of addressing impunity, but also for purposes of the rule of law in transitional justice, transitional society situations.
Thank you, all three of you, very much for being with us. David Kaye, Executive Director of UCLA Law School's International Human Rights Law Program and Director of the International Justice Clinic there. Mark Drumble, Professor at Washington and Lee University School of Law and Director of the Transnational Law Institute there. Also author of the award-winning Atrocity Punishment in International Law. Hannah Gary with us, Director of USC Law's International Human Rights Clinic and specializing in international human rights law, international criminal law, and international humanitarian law. Thank you, all three of you, so very much.
Thank you, Maria.
Thank you.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests, and special thanks to Ankina Aghasian, Melissa Ciprin, Ishmael Karim, and Amanda Vigil, who helped produce today's show. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed any part of the show, go to kpfk.org and click on the audio archives. You can also keep up with us at scholarcircle.org or armudian.com, or follow me on Twitter at armudian.